and released, because that's control. It's not a random event. It's not a probabilistic event anymore. And the vaccine is also part of the exact same plot. It's all a plot. For some people, even though they claim to be outraged by it, they would rather live in a world where everything is controlled by man rather than things that can happen that are left to chance, unpredictable, bad things. That's at the root of much conspiracism. Okay, last one today. Here's a bonus. This one came in via Facebook on Monday morning. This is from George. This is really wild. George says, "You keep calling Trump supporters delusional. I truly hope that you open your eyes before the communist, Democrat, Nazi party come for you." A few contradictions there. Trump did not lose the 2020 election. It was part of a colors revolution. Colors revolution. Educate yourself, educate your followers, and open your eyes. Otherwise, you might just find yourself, you might find yourself on that train, just like the Jews found themselves on a Nazi train. Except this time it won't be gas. It'll be an injection. They call it a vaccine, dumbass. Folks, this is what we're up against. We're going to have to try to solve the problems of humanity despite people like this. I don't see any way to get them to help us. Maybe we can prevent them from hurting us. Maybe. But it is not looking very good. Not looking very good. Get your emails in for next week's mailbag, info@davidpakman.com. We have a fantastic bonus show today. It's all me today on the bonus show. I know many people expecting only producer Pat today. It's all me. I will see you on the bonus show.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
This is Grant Lee Phillips telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest, WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know, go Steelers.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yow.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT in sound from way out.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
RCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz, PhD.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you. DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP. Due to a request by Computing Services, the remainder of this announcement cannot be aired.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This year, the Red Nation is preparing for its 6th annual Indigenous Peoples Day march and rally here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It is a victory won by Native people here that is a culmination of years of continuous resistance to colonialism on Tiwa territory. We want to remind people, specifically Native people, that this is our victory. It is a people's victory. Despite the fact that Biden has recently signed this proclamation, let it be known that this day to remember our struggles cannot be co-opted by anyone.
President Biden's issued the first ever presidential proclamation of Indigenous Peoples Day, following a growing movement to debunk the myth of Christopher Columbus as beneficent discoverer. We'll go to New Mexico to speak with Jennifer Marley, a member of the Red Nation, and we'll talk to historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, and her new book, Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Elimination. Then this week, thousands of Indigenous leaders and climate justice activists are calling on Biden to declare a climate emergency as the Enbridge Line 3 oil pipeline in Minnesota reportedly becomes operational, which could double Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. We'll speak with Winona LaDuke, longtime Indigenous activist who's been organizing for years to block the pipeline.
This is a plea to President Joe Biden. This is a plea to Governor Tim Walz. This is a plea to Senators Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar to be leaders, to do the right thing for the people of Minnesota, for the waters of our Great Lake Superior, for future generations and for the Anishinaabe.
Finally, we look at one of the two journalists awarded the Nobel Peace Prize Friday, Dmitry Muratov, editor-in-chief of the Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, which has lost more journalists to murder than any other Russian news outlet.
This award is for Anna Politskovskaya, Yuri Shekochkin, Igor Donnikov, Anastasia Baburova, Stas Merkelov, Natasha Estimarova, our fallen professionals who gave their lives for the profession. I am not the right beneficiary for this prize.
We'll speak with Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation magazine, who's been reporting on Russia for the last 30 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The pharmaceutical company Merck has asked drug regulators in the United States and Europe to authorize the first antiviral pill to treat COVID-19 patients at home. Public health officials hope approval of the drug, molnupiravir, could help reduce the strain on hospitals. In other pandemic news, the official COVID death toll in Brazil's topped 600,000, the second highest official total in the world, behind the United States, where over 713,000 people have died. More than 130 countries, including every G20 nation, have agreed to a global deal to ensure large corporations pay a global minimum tax rate of 15%. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, described the agreement as a, quote, landmark deal. French Economy Minister Bruno Le Maire spoke on Friday.
Cet accord ouvre la voie à une véritable révolution fiscale.
The deal opens the path to a true fiscal revolution for the 21st century. It's a fiscal revolution, first, because there is no going back. It's a fiscal revolution because it brings more justice in the matter of taxation. Finally, digital giants will pay their fair share of taxes in countries, including France, where they are making a profit.
Critics of the global tax deal say a 15% tax rate's too low. Susana Ruiz of Oxfam said, quote, this deal is a shameful and dangerous capitulation to the low tax model of nations like Ireland. It's a mockery of fairness that robs pandemic-ravaged developing countries of badly needed revenue for hospitals and teachers and better jobs, she said. In Afghanistan, a suicide attack killed dozens of worshippers at a Shiite mosque in the northern city of Kunduz on Friday. The militant group Islamic State Khorasan, or ISIS-K, claimed responsibility for the blast, which killed as many as 72 people. It was the deadliest attack in Afghanistan since U.S. troops left the country. Meanwhile, the Taliban and the United States held talks in Doha over the weekend. According to the Taliban, the U.S. has agreed to provide humanitarian aid to Afghanistan, where the United Nations estimates 1 million children are at risk of starvation. Iraqis headed to the polls Sunday for just the fifth parliamentary election since the U.S. overthrow of Saddam Hussein in 2003. Turnout was just 41%, with many Iraqis refusing to vote. This is Hussein Sabah, a 20-year Iraqi from Basra.
I did not vote, to be honest. It is not worth it. There's nothing that would benefit me or others. I see youth that have degrees and no jobs. Before the elections, they all came to them. After the elections, who knows?
In Lebanon, electricity has been partially restored after a 24-hour nationwide blackout following the collapse of the state-run electrical grid Saturday. Lebanon's two largest power plants run out of fuel. This comes as Lebanon's facing a growing economic and political crisis. Mohamed Rizik is a restaurant owner in Beirut.
Electricity used to be available for 2 hours, 1 hour during the daytime and 2 hours at night. Now there is nothing. Our cost doubled. Gas and fuel prices went up. This is not normal. We are destroyed.
Tension remains high between China and Taiwan. On Saturday, Chinese President Xi Jinping called for Taiwan to be peacefully reunited with mainland China.
National reunification by peaceful means best serves the interests of the Chinese nation as a whole, which includes our compatriots in Taiwan. We will maintain our basic policies of peaceful reunification and one country, two systems, uphold the One China principle and the 1992 consensus, and we will work to promote the peaceful development of cross-strait relations.
Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen responded on Sunday, saying Taiwan would not bow to pressure from China.
We will not act rashly, but there should be absolutely no illusions that the Taiwanese people will bow to pressure. We will continue to bolster our national defense and demonstrate our determination to defend ourselves in order to ensure that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for us.
In Libya, at least six refugees were shot dead Friday by guards in an overcrowded prison camp. In recent weeks, armed forces in western Libya have detained over 5,100 refugees, including hundreds of children, as part of a sweeping crackdown. On Sunday, hundreds of refugees gathered outside a United Nations facility in Tripoli trying to escape from Libya. Fatima is a refugee from Sudan.
I want to leave Libya. I want to evacuate us from Libya. This is what I want. We are tired. We have no food and no shelter. They attacked us with bullets. They took us to jail with no food or drink. We left prison and came here. Even the children have nothing to eat.
As many as 70,000 people marched in the Belgium capital of Brussels Sunday, demanding world leaders do more to combat the climate emergency. The protest comes just weeks before a major UN climate summit begins in Glasgow, Scotland. Meanwhile, here in the United States, the New York Times is reporting Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona wants to cut at least $100 billion in climate funds from the bills at the center of President Biden's economic agenda. Both Sinema and fellow Democrat Joe Manchin have opposed the size of the $3.5 trillion bill over 10 years to expand the nation's safety net and combat the climate crisis. Texas's near-total ban on abortion is back in effect, after a federal appeals court ruling Friday. The court said the state could temporarily resume its ban on most abortions, reversing a decision by a federal judge just 2 days earlier. Nancy Northup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, condemned the appeals court decision, saying, quote, "The Supreme Court needs to step in and stop this madness. It's unconscionable that the Fifth Circuit stayed such a well-reasoned decision that allowed constitutionally protected services to return in Texas," she said. The NAACP is denouncing the recent violent arrest in Dayton, Ohio, of a black man who is paraplegic. Newly released police body cam video shows officers dragged Clifford Owensby out of his car and yanked him by his hair after a traffic stop. Officers ignored repeated pleas from Owensby, saying he was paraplegic. A warning to our audience, this video includes disturbing images of police violence. The Justice Department has announced it will not file federal charges against the white police officer in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who fired 7 shots at point-blank range into the back of Jacob Blake last year. The shooting left the 29-year-old African-American father partially paralyzed. The officer, Rustin Chesky, shot Blake as he leaned into his car. 3 of Blake's young sons witnessed the shooting from inside the car. The boys were 3, 5, and 8 years old at the time. The Justice Department said there was insufficient evidence that the officers willfully used excessive force. To see our interview with Jacob Blake's father, visit democracynow.org. More than 220 immigrant and human rights groups are urging the Biden administration to immediately halt all efforts to expand immigration detention and terminate contracts with private prisons to hold immigrants. The groups have also denounced plans for 2 facilities in Pennsylvania, the planned reopening of the Moshannon Valley Correctional Center and the planned expansion of an immigration jail in Berks County. In news from Guatemala, 126 people were found locked in an abandoned shipping container over the weekend. They were freed after local residents heard screaming and shouting from inside. The majority of the people locked inside were Haitian asylum seekers who were hoping to make it to the U.S. border. The Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol is threatening to file criminal charges against former Trump advisor Steve Bannon for refusing to comply with a subpoena. Bannon defended his decision, citing Trump's directive to former aides not to cooperate with the probe. Meanwhile, President Biden's rejected Trump's request to withhold White House records related to the insurrection from the House committee. And Pakistani nuclear scientist AQ Khan has died at the age of 85. Khan helped Pakistan build its nuclear arsenal. He later confessed to smuggling nuclear weapons blueprints to other countries, including Iran, North Korea, and Libya, in one of the world's largest nuclear proliferation scandals. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the first time the United States as a nation will recognize the second Monday of October as Indigenous Peoples Day. This follows a growing movement to debunk the myth of Christopher Columbus as beneficent discoverer and replace it with recognition that the arrival of Christopher Columbus in the Bahamas unleashed a brutal genocide that massacred tens of millions of Native peoples across the hemisphere. President Biden Friday issued the first ever presidential proclamation of Indigenous Peoples Day to honor, quote, "our diverse history and the Indigenous peoples who contribute to shaping this nation." Indigenous Peoples Day is now a paid state holiday in Alaska, Iowa, Maine, Minnesota, New Mexico, Nevada, North Carolina, Oregon, which celebrates both Columbus Day and Native American Day, and South Dakota, Vermont, and Wisconsin. More than 100 U.S. cities have also replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. Even Columbus, Ohio, the largest city named after the Italian invader, stopped celebrating Columbus Day in 2018. Last year, it declared October 12th Indigenous Peoples Day, with the Columbus City Council President Shannon Harden saying, quote, "It's impossible to think about a more just future without recognizing these original sins of our past," she said. On Friday, Associated Press reporter Amar Madani questioned White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about Indigenous Peoples Day.
The president became the first U.S. president to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day. Why should the U.S. Continue to celebrate Columbus Day? And has there been any talk or discussion of, as many cities and I think a few states have shifted from Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day?
Well, today is both Columbus Day, as of now, and this is why you're asking the question, as well as Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm not aware of any discussion of ending that, either of ending the prior federal holiday at this point. But I know that recognizing today as Indigenous Peoples Day is something that the president felt strongly about personally. He's happy to be the first president to celebrate and to make it the history of moving forward.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In New Mexico, Jennifer Marley, a member of the Red Nation, a grassroots Indigenous liberation organization that helped lead a campaign in 2015 to officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's a citizen of San Ildefonso Pueblo and a PhD student in the American Studies Department at the University of New Mexico. Also with us from San Francisco, one of the first cities to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day, is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, historian and author of many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States and, most recently, Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Elimination. It includes a chapter on Columbus and so-called Columbus Day. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, let's begin with you. San Francisco, very early on, I believe decades ago, recognized Indigenous Peoples Day. Can you talk about the first presidential proclamation, Biden on Friday, recognizing it, that the significance of this?
Well, thank you, Amy, and hello, Jennifer. Yeah, you know, actually, it was Berkeley that first recognized Indigenous Peoples Day in 1992 during the quincentennial. San Francisco came, I think, about 5 or 6 years later. But Berkeley, you know, things start in Berkeley. People think they're crazy there, and then suddenly it's everywhere. So that was important. It was an effort of Ohlone people, Native people from all over Northern California, and wonderful allies in Berkeley. So that was the beginning. We haven't gotten rid of Fleet Week, which just was here for a week, warships in our bay, and the Blue Angels strafing us for 5 days to celebrate Columbus and the Italian parade in North Beach. So it's still, you know, Columbus is still being celebrated. But I think it's important to know that ever since the holiday has been, since Franklin Roosevelt made it a federal holiday, Native people have spoken out against this. And it can be documented back into the 1940s. But especially in 1977, when Indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere went to the United Nations, to the Palais de Nation in Geneva, where the human rights bodies are located, and were welcomed there, 100 representatives. And one of the main demands they made in the, you know, which finally became the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2007, was that October 12th be considered and named the International Day of Solidarity and Mourning with the Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. And I think that was when internationally and nationally that the real movement was set off. And of course, we had looming ahead of us the quincentenary of 1992, which Spain and the United States in particular teamed up to make a huge celebration worldwide. They failed miserably, thanks to Native people mobilizing, not just in the Western Hemisphere, but really all over the world. So I think the developments at the UN with the indigenous peoples going onto the world stage has really made this possible. I never thought I would see it, in the 1960s or 70s, it didn't seem like there would ever be any questioning of the role of Columbus. But it will be a long struggle still. It's just not appropriate to celebrate Columbus and indigenous peoples on the same day. It's a contradiction. One is a genocidal enslavement is what Columbus represents, and the situation of Native people today, still under colonialism, with shrunken land bases and not true sovereignty, is the fruit of that beginning. And they're completely contradictory. So it will, you know, would require an act of Congress, and that would be difficult. The Italian community and the Catholic Church would definitely oppose this. So we have really a long ways to go to make it real. But as Jennifer said, it's the Indigenous Peoples Day, and it cannot be co-opted into tolerating Columbus being alongside it.
You write in Teen Vogue, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, as of 2020, there were some 150 statues of Columbus across the U.S., most but not all of them the work of the Catholic lay organization, the Knights of Columbus, and Italian communities. During the Black Lives Matter mass mobilization in 2020, at least 33 of the statues were either pulled down by protesters or removed by authorities for safekeeping storage. Can you talk about the forces behind this recent activism?
Well, I think the most significant part of that, and Jennifer knows it, you know, on the ground, is the Black Lives Matter led movement teamed up. I think it was when it was Albuquerque and Minnesota, especially, where the fusion of and solidarity like I've never seen came together to take down those Columbus statues in Albuquerque and Minneapolis, and also in Albuquerque, the Spanish, the Spanish conquistadors who are so worshipped by the Hispanos there, and that was really significant. I think one thing that surprised me was when they were taking them down in the state capitol. I actually was not aware that they had a Queen Isabella statue there too. So that was taken down as well. The Spanish conqueror of Mexico and where New Mexico and of course California are. So we have a double whammy here in the Southwest in California of the Spanish conquest and Columbus really being closer to the grain than most U.S. Anglo people really understand. So I think that's why you find such profound actions in New Mexico and Tehuacan land that Jennifer is in, this is going to be this is a real leadership, you know, really of the national and, Native movement.
And we're going to go to New Mexico in 1 minute, but I wanted to ask you about your latest book, Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Elimination. Before that, an Indigenous People's History of the United States. Not an immigrant nation. You're sort of debunking that term that President Kennedy coined, right? An immigrant nation.
Yes, as John F. Kennedy, when he was senator, wrote a little book, published it, which has been a bestseller ever since. And it really seeped into the whole liberal culture, I would say. I don't think right-wingers, you know, carry that book around. But it was called The Nation of Immigrants. And, of course, he was Catholic and a child of Irish immigrants, and this had never happened before. A president that was not Anglo-Saxon or Scots-Irish and descended from the original settlers. So he had quite a hill to climb to make himself palatable. So I think that the way was already paved, I think, by the previous half century or more with the work of the Knights of Columbus. The Knights were formed in 1882 and by Irish clerics. Most of the Irish famine immigrants who had come in the 1840s, and really refugees, it took, you know, 20 or 30 years to sort of assimilate into, they had an advantage of speaking English, unlike the Italians who came in the 1890s and turn of the century in great numbers. So they absorbed, they really presented, the Catholic Church presented to the Italian this idea of the lineage of Columbus. And it was already there in the political or, you know, mythical culture in the United States of they actually discussed, I didn't know this till I did the research, they actually discussed the founders naming the United States Columbia, which is Latin for the land of Columbus. And that really was surprising to me, because I thought it was really more an invention of the late 19th century with the Knights of Columbus. But there is this mythology of Columbus as the founder of the United States, the actual founder of the United States. So I think that attachment, that makes me better understand that attachment to Columbus statues everywhere, that is kind of in the, it's not spoken about, but it's just kind of in the culture. And then, of course, it was greatly amplified by Italians taking it up as it's a way of becoming Americanized. And, of course, there was no Italy when Columbus, he's from Genoa, a city-state. He died in Spain. So it's a very weak link to Italianness. And of course, Italians have such illustrious people they can celebrate, that everyone celebrates, and Michelangelo, and Vivaldi, and of course, for us on the left, Sacco and Vanzetti, you know, it really is. I think we have to really talk about this. And I think it's important, you know, these symbols are very important for how people think, the kind of Americanism and, you know, a patriotism that is based on such falsehood, and the reality of slavery, enslavement of Africans, which is a part of that package of Columbus. The Holy See the papal bulls had already given Africa to the Portuguese when Columbus came to the Americas. And then they gave, through a papal bull, 1493, gave all the Americas to the Spanish. They could enslave. It was the permission to enslave legally under the Holy Roman Empire. So it's, it's a very, very, very deep history. I tried to do not making it too, archival and hard to read, but just laying it out. And I think the book has a dynamism simply because I was learning so much as I wrote it.
Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, I want to thank you for being with us, historian and author of many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States, and most recently, her book, Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Elimination. Next up, we go to New Mexico, a site of major indigenous activism. We'll speak with a member of Red Nation, which helped lead the campaign for Albuquerque to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day. Stay with us.
One earth, one people, one love. One earth, one people, one love. One earth, one people, one love. One earth, one people, one love.
First off, let's define indigenous, the native people, original inhabitants, living on every single continent. Then somebody shows up and says, I discovered it. How can you discover somewhere already found or take credit for a place that's already around, like Hernan Cortez or Hernando de Soto, Ponce de Leon or Francisco Pizarro? It all started with Christopher Columbus, Europe's obsession with Western discovering, with big dreams. It's while an Italian was searching for gold in the East Indies Islands. Long ago, 1492, we all know the story, he sailed the ocean blue. But here's what I didn't learn in school. After landing in the Bahamas, he treated people cruel. The Tainos are peaceful people in Cuba, Haiti, DR, Jamaica, Puerto Rico. Even though they welcomed him with open arms, he committed genocide and unspeakable evil. I wish that's where the story ends, but colonization is a sickness that spreads. Speaking of sickness, literal diseases, smallpox, chickenpox, and the measles. I wonder how history would change if explorers were peaceful when they came, learned native customs, cultural exchange, didn't force religion, and no one was enslaved. Aztecs, Incas might have lived longer from South America to Canadian borders. Cherokee, Sioux, Apache, and Navajo, Iroquois, Chippewa, Choctaw, Pueblo.
Indigenous Peoples Day song remix by Fiuch with Rudmila Cody. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our look at Indigenous Peoples Day, we go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're joined by Jennifer Marley, a member of the Red Nation, a citizen of the San Ildefonso Pueblo. She's a PhD student in American Studies at the Department, American Studies Department, University of New Mexico. The Red Nation, which helped lead a campaign in 2015 to officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Jennifer, if you can talk about how you're recognizing this day and also respond to President Biden, the first president to officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day.
Good morning, Amy. I'm happy to be here. This year we're celebrating our sixth annual Indigenous Peoples Day march and rally, but it's much more than just a celebration. We're always reminding people that Indigenous Peoples Day is about creating space for people to recognize that colonization is ongoing, but our struggles for resistance are ongoing as well. And this year, Biden signed this proclamation, and we were all looking at it yesterday morning when it came out, and we were kind of laughing at the irony that although he signed this proclamation, Columbus Day still is not abolished or redacted. It's still recognized. And so, like Roxanne said, it's a contradiction. And we also know that Indigenous Peoples Day is being co-opted not only by state governments and the federal government, but by even city officials And we're actually dealing with that this year locally. And again, there's irony because the city gave us such pushback when we were first trying to implement it back in 2015.
So can you talk about what you're doing in New Mexico? I mean, it's expected that thousands of people will be pressing on a fossil-free America in Washington, D.C. People versus fossil fuels is the major event, thousands taking direct nonviolent action in the nation's capital to demand President Biden end the era of fossil fuels. Talk about that organizing and New Mexico's.
Sure. So we're actually sending some Red Nation folks up to D.C. tomorrow to join that. And, you know, we always make sure that our struggles are connected to those that are happening not only around, you know, throughout the nation, but throughout the world. Internationalism is very important to us because when we're talking about resource extraction, we can't de-link it from the global chain of resource extraction. And so we know that this is a fight that indigenous peoples are at the forefront of all around the world. We know that native lands are disproportionately used for resource extraction. And here in New Mexico, we refer to New Mexico as, you know, what is a legal resource colony, a contemporary resource colony, because of the way resources are extracted here at such high rates. So there's gas and oil. We know that New Mexico became the second biggest oil producing state in the United States this past year, which really translates to being one of the biggest oil producers in the world. And we know that this is also the birthplace of the atomic bomb. It was actually Manhattan Project took place on my people's lands. And it's one of the only states where the entire resource or the entire supply chain for the construction of a bomb can take place within this one state, so much so that if New Mexico were to secede as its own nation, it would automatically be the world's third strongest nuclear superpower. And so resource extraction literally shapes the economy of New Mexico. Lawmakers are constantly reminding us that we need to be in favor of a further resource extraction because it's what funds education and it's what funds, you know, our basic needs here as New Mexicans. And so we have been fighting a long fight against resource extraction here, especially as it pertains to the Diné community surrounding Chaco Canyon and Chaco Canyon itself, which is you know, a site of ancestral significance for all of us here in New Mexico, all of us indigenous people here. And so that is a fight that continues. And, you know, it's going to be a long one, right? Because right now, as it stands, the state officials and government officials continue to look at New Mexico as a source of wealth because of the abundant resources here that exist primarily on indigenous lands.
I'd like to turn to a recent tweet from Nick Estes, a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, a member of the Red Nation, assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, where you are, Jennifer. On Saturday, he tweeted, "Biden didn't abolish the genocidal celebration of Columbus Day, which has been a primary demand of the Indigenous Peoples Day movement. He just all lives mattered it." If you could also talk about the Red Deal. I mean, as the Democratic Party is fighting within itself to fight to the progressives within it to push for this $3.5 trillion 10-year deal that really focuses on the climate emergency, can you talk about what Red Nation's demands are?
All right, yeah. So in the Red Deal, we look at three areas of struggle. The first being end the occupation. So this is referring to the end of settler colonial projects everywhere, ending the occupation here, the occupation of native lands here, but also ending the occupation of all native lands everywhere. So we're talking about Palestine. We're looking at the global south. We're looking at everywhere imperialism has touched. And we're also talking about the abolishment of the police. We're looking at, you know, the end of carceral, you know, justice. And we're looking at the end of ICE, Immigration Enforcement, CBP, and border imperialism. And so that's in the occupation. The second part is heal our planet. And so with this, we're looking at the actual remediation of lands, which requires, of course, first and foremost, land back, right? That's the big call that Native people have. And, you know, though it's often misconstrued, unfortunately, even by the left, it's something that has attached to it real material demands that are plausible. And it's also not unprecedented when we're looking at, you know, what decolonization looks like globally. And the third area is heal our bodies. So in order to heal our bodies, we know that we need to heal the earth. We need to make it so that the land we live on are not irradiated or poisonous, and that we actually have access to land to sustain ourselves, that we can control the distribution and selling of our resources, and that the people themselves have a stake in how our economies are created. And also, of course, this relates to the assertion of sovereignty, true sovereignty for Native people, our ability to engage in trade and commerce with other nations outside the U.S. and, you know, maybe create some kind of plurinationalism, as many of our Indigenous relatives in South America have. And healing our bodies, of course, requires the reclamation of Indigenous foodways, waterways, ways of caring for the land, and our overall stewardship. We know that Indigenous people make up not a great population worldwide, I mean, much more than in the United States, but we caretake 80% of the world's biodiversity. So it's very clear that when the land is Indigenous people's hands, it's able to thrive. The earth is able to thrive. And so the Red Deal calls for an end to imperialism, an end to capitalism, an end to genocidal violence, and focuses on caretaking our earth, caretaking each other, and caretaking ourselves, ultimately.
Well, Jennifer Marley, I want to thank you for being with us, member of the Red Nation, a citizen of San Ildefonso Pueblo, speaking to us from Albuquerque, where major events are taking place today on Indigenous Peoples Day. We'll also link at democracynow.org to our April interview with members of the Red Nation, co-authors of The Red Deal, Indigenous Action to Save Our Earth. This is Democracy Now! As we continue to talk about Indigenous action to save our earth. This week, thousands of Indigenous leaders and climate justice advocates are expected to participate in a historic 5-day massive action of civil disobedience at the White House to continue to pressure President Biden to declare a climate emergency, divest from fossil fuels, and launch a, quote, just renewable energy revolution. The People versus Fossil Fuels mobilization, led by the Indigenous Environmental Network, 350.org, Sunrise Movement, the Center for Biological Diversity, and others, comes as Canadian pipeline company Enbridge has completed the construction of its contested Line 3 crude oil pipeline in northern Minnesota. The pipeline's reportedly now operational, violating the treaty rights of local Indigenous communities. Line 3 is set to carry over 500,000 barrels of tar sands oil every day from Alberta, Canada, through Minnesota to the tip of Lake Superior in Wisconsin, threatening sacred wild rice watersheds in Minnesota, local waters and lands, and doubling Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. Indigenous leaders and land and water defenders who've been resisting Line 3 for years, often putting their own bodies on the line, vowed to continue to fight against the pipeline. Last week, a small group of water protectors confronted Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar at a fundraising event where advocates say plates cost $1,000 a person, demanding her to take action against Line 3.
We're asking you to call on President Biden to stop Line 3. It has a higher carbon footprint than the entire state of Minnesota. And this climate crisis, I mean, you saw Hurricane Ida. You saw how many people died. And we just really need you to call on him and ask him to stop it. Because you have so much power. You have so much power. And as a young person, the climate crisis is something that really concerns me. And stopping Line 3. We can't have climate justice without you stopping Line 3 and asking President Biden. I know that you don't have a vote, and I know that you can't vote in the Senate to stop Line 3, but President Biden has that power, and you have the power.
You have the power. More than 900 water protectors have been arrested over their resistance to Line 3, with some protesters facing felony charges as they were brutalized by police. Some water protectors also reported being denied medical care and being placed in solitary confinement after their arrests. Well, the Guardian newspaper revealed last week that Enbridge paid Minnesota police $2.4 million in reimbursements, all costs tied to the arrests and surveillance of hundreds of water protectors, including officer training, wages, overtime, meals, hotels, and equipment for the local police paid for by an international corporation. For more, we're joined in Ponceford, Minnesota by Winona LaDuc, longtime Indigenous activist who's been organizing for years to block Enbridge Line 3. She lives and works on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota as executive director of Honor the Earth. Her piece for the Minneapolis Star Tribune is headlined, Line 3 Opponents Can Savor This Defeat, her latest book, To Be a Water Protector. Winona, welcome back to Democracy Now! So, if you can talk about these latest revelations of this Canadian company paying the local police to arrest you all, and also what it means that Enbridge says Line 3 is operational.
Just Line 3 is operational, we'll say that. They've been hurrying really fast because the federal court has yet to rule on whether Enbridge has any ability to move forward. There's no federal environmental impact statement on this project, which is why we want Joe Biden to stop it. I mean, they stole 5 billion gallons of water, fracked 28 rivers out, and then they have this broken aquifer losing 100,000 gallons a day of water. They have no idea how to fix this stuff since January. It's, you know, it's really horrible up here. So, you know, Enbridge has been trying to rush to get this online before the court will rule against them, because generally courts have not ruled in favor of pipelines. That's the status that we have seen, you know, in the federal court ruling on the DAPL, where the federal court ordered them to close down. This is the same company. Enbridge was 28% of DAPL. And when the federal court ordered them to close down the pipe, they said no. When the state of Michigan ordered them to close down a pipe this last May, they said no. So they're just trying to continue their egregious behavior. And it's so tragic that, you know, on one hand, the Biden administration is like, we are going to have Indigenous Peoples Day, but we're still going to smash you in northern Minnesota and smash the rest of the country. Same thing, you know, Klobuchar and Smith, the two Minnesota senators, shameful. Their lack of courage, not only for Indigenous people, but for the planet, you know. So Enbridge is trying to get that oil out. In the meantime, it's a disaster up here. I'm still up here monitoring the line and monitoring what's going on, because it's crazy. And just to say, they don't have Indigenous Peoples Day apparently in Becker County, because I have a court date today. So, you know, no break for Indigenous people. You can still go to court. You know, it's just insane up here.
So how does your activism change now that it's supposedly operational, the pipeline? And what exactly does it mean? For people who aren't familiar with Line 3, talk about its course from Canada through the United States and why you're so concerned about this particular pipeline.
Okay, well, first of all, the pipeline is 915,000 barrels a day of oil. That's a lot of oil. It's going to move through it if they get their way. And that oil, like, this is the last tar sands pipeline. Now, how we know this is the last tar sands pipeline is that our alma mater, remember, Amy, when we were at Harvard, trying to get them to divest in South Africa? No, but they just are divesting in fossil fuels. Everybody is fleeing the tar sands. And it's an industry that's at its end. Like, Canada needs to quit trying to breathe life into the tar sands and breathe life into boarding schools and residential schools. They need to just stop being the criminals that they are. You know, so forcing them, they're 4 years behind schedule if they get to oil. And in that 4 years behind schedule, the industry is falling apart. There's no new investment in tar sands infrastructure, and it's the dirtiest oil in the world. Then add to that the fact that the company can't even get insurance for its pipeline. Like, I'm just trying to understand what kind of fiscal and responsibility exists in the state of Minnesota that Enbridge divulged a couple of weeks ago that they can't get insurance for their pipeline. And so you have an accident, it's going to be just like Bhopal and Union Carbide. These guys are going to pack up and go back to Canada. You know, I mean, it is a really horrific situation. And, you know, the impact of it is so wrong. You know, I mean, it's not only the equivalent of 50 new coal-fired power plants, but right now, you know, our rivers are dry. They took 5 billion gallons of water from the north. This is, you know, Enbridge and the Walz administration are climate criminals, and the Biden administration needs to stand up. You know, on one hand, I'm looking at Joe Biden, I'm so grateful, like bear's ears. That was the right thing to do, you know, to get back and to be the people that, you know, are are supporting indigenous people and land back. Let's go, Joe. Let's go, Joe. You know, 80 million acres of national parks stolen from Indian people. Let's start returning those too. You know, along with creating new national parks, we could just start returning land that was stolen. That'd be a great step. You know, and then actually when you have indigenous people in your administration, Joe, like Deb Haaland or maybe Jamie Pinkham at the Army Corps of Engineers, let them do their job instead of having politics, oily politics, intervene. You know, I know that Deb Haaland does not support this pipeline. No sane person supports this pipeline. Only people who want to take oil money from Canadian multinationals support this pipeline. And I know that Jamie Pinkham, assistant in the Army Corps of Engineers, came up and visited and saw what was going on in the disaster. Our tribes have sued, you know, trying to stop this. Sued in federal court. That federal court hearing is yet. And our tribes also have a tribal court hearing where the federal courts have ordered Enbridge to come to our court because we say that they're climate criminals and they're destroying the rights of wild rice. Actually, the state DNR has been ordered into tribal court. You know, so, Joe, if you appoint Indian people, don't just make them pretty Indian people that sit in your administration. Let them do their job. Indigenous thinking is what we need in the colonial administration. That's when change happens.
As we wrap up, Winona, in August, you met with the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders to share the police violence suffered by water protectors protesting the Line 3 construction site. And now we are learning just how much money the Canadian corporation gave to the local police to do the arrests, to do the training, etc. What happened with the UN Rapporteur?
The UN Rapporteur has asked the United States a bunch of questions and is expecting a response on what exactly the United States is planning to do to protect, you know, the human rights of indigenous peoples, because this pipeline does not respect not only treaty rights, but, you know, when you get 900 people arrested and they're brutalized, you know, with all kinds of, you know, I mean, it is torture. Some of what was done to these people is, you know, classified as it's excessive force. You know, so the United Nations has called to task the United States on the Enbridge pipeline, you know, and so in Indigenous Peoples Day, that's part of what we are saying too, is it's, you know, a time to account. And I just want to say that this isn't just like our problem, because the Enbridge model, like, first of all, Canadian multinationals kill people in third world countries. That's what they do. You know, that is known. 75% of the world's mining corporations are Canadian, and all through Latin America, there's human rights violations. This is no different. This is a Canadian multinational and Indigenous people. And 2 years ago, we told Attorney General for Minnesota, Keith Ellison, that this was going to be a problem. You know, we have had no action. And instead, what we have is, you know, our rights continue to be violated. And, you know, I've got charges in three counties, you know, more probably coming soon. I was like,
what do you face? You know,
and this is a national problem, because the Minnesota model is being considered nationally, that corporations should finance your police. And that is, in any way you look at it, that's definitely a violation of the public trust to have corporations financed by the police, you know, and
what charges do you face, Winona?
I've got trespassing, obstruction. I think I've got some public safety, you know, causing public safety problems because cops could have been doing something else instead of monitoring people on the pipeline. A lot of trespassing charges. Aiken, Hubbard, Wadena County. I've got charges in three counties so far.
Well, best of luck to you today in court. Winona LaDuke, longtime Indigenous activist, executive director of Honor the Earth, speaking to us from northern Minnesota. When we come back, we look at the Russian journalist who was just awarded the Nobel Peace Prize on Friday. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. That was Stadium Powwow, the Halluci Nation. I'm Amy Goodman. Two journalists were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize Friday, or the announcement of the award, in recognition for their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression and as symbolic of journalists globally fighting to protect press freedom. On Friday, we reported on Maria Ressa, the Filipina investigative journalist, executive editor and founder of the news site Rappler. Today, we look at her Nobel Peace Prize co-winner, Dmitry Muratov, the editor-in-chief of the Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, which has lost more journalists to murder than any other Russian news outlets. Six of its staff members have been killed since 1993. For more, we're joined by Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post. She's been reporting on Russia for more than 30 years. Her latest piece in The Nation, A Courageous Voice for Press Freedom and Independence in Russia. Katrina, welcome back to Democracy Now! And condolences on the death of your father. I wanted to start by talking about this work you've been doing for so many decades and the winner of the one of the two winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, Dmitry Muratov.
So I and my late husband, Stephen Cohen, met Dmitry in the cafeteria, the basement cafeteria of a then bold Glasnost newspaper, Moscow News. He was there with a few colleagues. They wanted to launch an independent, muckraking newspaper, and they had two desks, two computers, and just about that, and they launched. And it is a survival, a testament to the ability to survive if you're a bold, creative editor, which I knew he was. What I didn't understand was how he would become an advocate for freedom of the press against all odds. As you mentioned, Amy, six of his journalists have been killed in the line of duty. One of them, Anna Politkovskaya, was murdered in October 2006, ironically, sadly, just a day before Dima Muratov received the Nobel Prize in 2006, October 7. What he's become is the possibility of doing investigative journalism in Russia today is very dangerous. It's not just his journalists. There are others who have been killed. Yeltsin era, Putin era, and there's a culture of impunity, of failure to hold account those who are killing freedom of the press. On the other hand, Novaya has done some of the best independent, muckraking investigative journalism about abuse of power. They, in fact, covered Putin's abuses of corruption, the public officials' corruption, even before Navalny circulated his videos. Right-wing extremism, one of their young journalists, Yelena Milashina, covered the persecution of the LGBT community in Chechnya. So it's a dangerous, very dangerous profession. But Novaya has not only persevered, endured, but has younger journalists wanting to work for it. It has numbers that all of us would envy, about 30 million in social media each month, and 8 to 11 million readers come to its website. Print edition is smaller, but a younger generation is coming to it. So it survives, and I think this prize will both give it protection, but ironically will raise the question of foreign funds. We can talk about that, but there has been a trend of repressive media legislation, for example, if you take foreign money, being labeled foreign agent. So that will be interesting to see what happens. But I suspect this prize, for the most part, will give Novaya more protection.
And that point is something Dmitry Muratov raised. Also, your response to those who suggested Alexei Navalny should have been awarded the prize and that Muratov was really a compromise by the Nobel Committee so as not to offend the Kremlin. He himself said Alexei Navalny should have gotten it.
So Alexei Navalny, I think, he's an anti-corruption activist. He's also a political figure. I mean, he received 32% in the Moscow mayoral elections a few years ago. Novaya has covered the persecution of Alexei Navalny, very comprehensive coverage. But I do think of Navalny is not, he's an internet anti-corruption activist, and he also got very involved in the electoral scene in a way that Novaya steps back and reports, has its positions, obviously, but is honest about them. So I think there should be a calling out of the repression of the Putin administration vis-a-vis journalists, but not attacking Novaya. Novaya has attacked foreign agent labeling, has stood for Navalny's rights to expose corruption. So I think that is misinformed, and in fact, I think it's an attempt to divide those who stand for, you know, press freedom. Navalny, Muratov. I will say Muratov is an extraordinary. He has retained a sense of humanity and humor.
We're going to have to leave it there. Katrina Vandenhoevel, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we are joined for the full hour by Phyllis Bennis to discuss Afghanistan.
Phyllis Bennis is one of the most knowledgeable people in our movement about American imperialism and particularly what the United States has done to Afghanistan. It's a pleasure to have her.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Afghanistan had a progressive modernizing government in the 1970s. It was headed by the Afghan Communist Party, which was semi-independent of the Soviet Union. Women had the right to go to school. They did not wear burqas. They wore blue uniforms. Women had the right to a job. The infrastructure in Afghanistan was being built up with a lot of money from the Soviet Union. But the Afghan people fell victim to the Cold War against communism. The United States armed the Islamic fundamentalist Mujahideen in what became a full-scale civil war. They got help from the reactionary Pakistanis. The Afghan government invited the Soviet Union into Afghanistan. The Soviet Union got tied down in the battle and eventually withdrew. It so exhausted the Soviet Union economically and politically that by 1991, the Soviet government collapsed. President Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski, bragged about this as a great success for U.S. policy. The Taliban won the Civil War, including with a promise to end the shelling of Kabul, and came to power in Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden located himself and his al-Qaeda followers in that country. When the Twin Towers and the Pentagon were struck by al-Qaeda on 9/11, and so many people in the U.S. were paralyzed with grief and fear, the only response offered to the American people was revenge. This paved the way for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, which soon won overwhelming popular support. The U.S. government was not really interested in bringing democracy to or preserving women's rights in Afghanistan. The United States allied with the warlords of the Northern Alliance, showering them with money. Afghanistan became a tremendous supplier of heroin to the world market. Thousands of U.S. soldiers and over 150,000 Afghans died. Tens of thousands were wounded. Trillions of dollars were spent. The war was unwinnable. First, Donald Trump announced he would withdraw U.S. forces. Then Joe Biden took U.S. troops out of that country. What does the future hold for Afghanistan? We speak today with Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. wars, and U.N. issues. An expert on U.S. foreign policy, Phyllis is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Phyllis has served as an informal advisor to several top UN officials on Middle East issues and was twice shortlisted to become the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. She writes and does commentary about U.S. foreign policy. Phyllis has written books about Afghanistan, the War on Terror, Iraq, Iran, Israel, Palestine, and the United Nations. She recently wrote at The Nation, "President Biden was right to withdraw U.S. troops, but we should have no illusion that this will end the war for Afghans." Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Margie.
After 20 years of occupation, the most powerful military and economic power in the world left defeated. How did this happen? Why did the Afghans give up so easily when the U.S. troops pulled out? Would you characterize